All right. Hey, guys. Good morning. Again, my name is Randall. If you have a Bible, you're going to want to turn it to the book of Proverbs. So as Nathan mentioned, we're kind of wrapping up this weekend. This weekend, we're wrapping up our summer in the wisdom literature series. And we've kind of been all over the map, but primarily the bulk of what we've been in is the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is kind of unique in that really the author holds up these two kind of ways of life. Like you can choose the way of folly, or you can choose the way of wisdom, and makes a pretty good case, why not choosing the way of folly, rather choosing wisdom would be good for your life and those around you, and it's just good for humans. So we're going to wrap all of that up today. This weekend is Labor Day weekend, if you don't know. Now, here's the deal. By a show of hands, how many of you understand what Labor Day actually is? I don't. I don't know why I have my hand up right now. Because I don't. I don't think. If you were to ask me 24 hours ago what Labor Day is, I would be like, I don't know. I didn't learn it. I've never looked into it. I've never researched what Labor Day is. I did last night. So less than a full day ago, I looked into it. I Wikipedia'd what Labor Day is. I don't get it. I don't know. If you were like my most educated guess at this point, less than 24 hours ago, I'd be like, is childbirth? Is it something to do with that? I don't know. Is it like doula, midwife? I don't know. None of us know, but we just know we have Monday off, right? Which is exciting. All right. It's actually this. It's the commemoration of the labor movement. It's about how labor and everything that comes with work and everything associated with work, specifically here in this country, has promoted the well-being, both economical and like human flourishing here in this country. It's brought around all these advancements. And so I thought it would only be fitting as we wrap up our summer wisdom literature series that we would talk out of the book of Proverbs about what the Bible, specifically Proverbs, has to say about work and how we as humans are to relate to work, but maybe even a little bit more narrowly here for us today. It's not assuming that all of us are Jesus followers, but some of us are. How are we, as disciples of Jesus, supposed to relate to work? And so what's interesting about the book of Proverbs, as you kind of dive into it, more than it kind of comes up with like maybe a list or a bunch of categories or some like very specific instructions as to how we are to relate to work, it really addresses this. More than anything, the book of Proverbs, the author addresses what's broken when it comes to us and work and our relationship with work. And it does this by holding up these two illustrations or these two examples of the way that people approach their ideas of work. So let me just read this to you. This is in Proverbs chapter 6, verse kind of 6 through, I don't know, like 11 or so. And this begins to kind of put out for us at least one example. Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief officer or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man. So the first example, it's pretty clear there, is this example of the sluggard. The sluggard is mentioned over and over and over again in the book of Proverbs. And they do everything possible to avoid work. Anything that they can come up with that's not actually work, they will do to avoid work, to keep work, labor, effort at arm's length. I love this next verse, Proverbs 26. It's so good. It says, the sluggard says, hey, there's a lion on the road, right? There's a lion in the streets, right? As a door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. So the sluggard's excuse for not making it to work that day is there's lions out there, right? Try that tomorrow morning. Oh, wait, you're not going to go to work tomorrow. Try that Tuesday morning, right? And just go like, you know, I've heard things about lions out in the streets, and so I'm just not going to be able to make it today. And see what your employer says, right? It's not feasible. It's not a good excuse. But the sluggard's like, hey, I've heard things about lions in the streets. I'm not making it to work. So, and it goes on, as a door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed, right? So a sluggard's just like, I love bed. Bed is awesome. Comforters and blankets, and I just turn back and forth. And then it goes on, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish. There's a tasty dish of food there. It wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. Oh, it's so hard. Like, I've got my hands in the food, but just the thought of bringing the food to my mouth, like, that's not ever true for me. I am not the sluggard in this example, right? The food always finds its way where it needs to go. So it's just too much effort to bring that food to, it wears him out. And then I like this last part. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. I don't know why seven. I think even one would work. But the sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. So the sluggard says, I want to sleep. Highest value for me is rest and relaxation or recreation. And I want to keep work at arm's length. Now, the Proverbs, the author of Proverbs also talks about somebody at the other end of this spectrum. There's another brokenness addressed when it comes to work. Proverbs then points to what I would call the cheat. Okay, let me just show you one of the passages that addresses the cheat. And I'm only going to read this first verse. This whole Proverbs 11 goes on, and it's just kind of like too lengthy. But it starts with this kind of, it's a unique way to look at it. It says, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. And then it goes on to describe all the ways that the cheat will set the scales in his favor. He'll corrupt relationships. He'll corrupt work. He'll corrupt everything around them to tip those scales in his favor so that he can get what he wants. So that's the cheat. They're willing to use unjust measures or unequal weights to get what they want in their life, what is most valuable. So here's what this means. The person being described in these verses, they're willing to cut corners morally, relationally. Work and ethics go out the window as long as they can achieve what they're after. So this is a person that will do whatever it takes, step on whoever is in their way, just to get ahead. They actually approach work with kind of this like mercenary vengeance. And in their sinfulness, they think that they can get something out of work. In their brokenness, they think that the end result of their work and their labor is actually going to achieve for them something that's going to satisfy them, something that's going to meet their deepest longing and needs for identity and purpose. And they'll go after that by any means necessary. So as I was reading this and kind of thinking about these, I couldn't help but come up with two examples, not a big shocker here, but from cinematic history that I think that personify the character of the sluggard and the cheat. And maybe this will kind of resonate with you. I kept thinking about the sluggard. I was thinking about Jeff Bridges' character in The Big Lebowski. It kept coming to mind, okay? He plays the titular character named The Dude. Anybody seen the movie The Big Lebowski? Yeah, so he's like this perma-fried, ex-hippie, slacker. The totality of his aspirations includes sleeping, bowling, and drinking white Russians, which he calls Caucasians, okay? That's what he wants in his life. And the dude is willing to do whatever necessary to protect what he really values so he can just kind of persist in his slacker lifestyle. That's the dude. He's the sluggard. On the other end, unfortunately, like there's so many probably examples that we could come up with. On the other end of the spectrum, this is actually a real person. I was thinking about the cheat, and I was thinking about the character that Leonardo DiCaprio plays in this movie called The Wolf of Wall Street. He's a real character. His name's Jordan Belfort, and comes to kind of mind. And in reality, he's just this ruthless guy who's obsessed with wealth and power and position and the accumulation of stuff. And he's prepared to use unjust measures and waits to obtain that. He's willing to cut whatever corners necessary and go through or go over whoever or anyone that stands in his way to get what he wants. Here's what's fascinating. I don't know that like the sluggard and the cheat are like friends in life, right? But I think this is important to understand. I think that they share something in common, right? It begs the question here as you look through the book of Proverbs. This is what comes up over and over and over again. Not like a how to be a better worker, but it warns us of these two people that approach work, vocation, and labor in very different ways, but ultimately they're trying to produce the same outcome. So it kind of begs the question, why not more kind of a robust theology of vocation in the book of Proverbs? Why does the author not get more practical when it comes to work? How we as Jesus followers are supposed to think about it and actually carry work out. Why does the author of Proverbs not go there? Here's what I think. It comes back to the sluggard and it comes back to the cheat, right? And they have this relationship, both of them, that with work or labor or vocation that I think really reveals something about their heart. And I think what it really reveals about their heart is what they truly worship. So their attitude and how they live out work reveals deeply what they worship. And worship is determined not merely by singing. We think about that often. But I think worship is really determined by the direction of your affections. What are you giving your time and your energy and your resources and your heart to? The direction of your affections. What's the deepest longing of your soul? What's your deepest desire? What do you give yourself to find identity and security and meaning and purpose and joy and life? What is it that you run to that names you, that gives you this sense of like definition that you might ultimately hope is going to somehow complete you? Whatever that is, that's what's sitting on the throne of your life, and it's what you are in fact worshiping. And so I think that what we see in these two examples, these two personality types as they approach work and how they express themselves in relation to that, I think it reveals what they truly worship. In the sluggard's life, work is a barometer for what he values most, what he's actually worshiping, because he's willing to sacrifice money and food and relationships, just like basic needs at times. Like, I'm not going to go to work so I can have the resources to get basic needs, because what I really value is just like recreation. What I really value is sleep. I value a life of leisure. What the slugger wants to avoid above all things is work. And what they want above all things is a life of comfort. So the sluggard wants more than even being able to put food on the table is comfort, relaxation, leisure. So the ultimate value for them is fun, like having fun in that moment, like drop everything that would be responsible in my life just to pursue the value of leisure and recreation and fun and comfort. And then when you look at the cheat, and it feels very different, the cheat, they're willing to step on people. They're willing to cut corners, right? The cheat's even willing to risk their freedom to be incarcerated, to get what they think is going to fulfill and complete them. They'll distance themselves relationally. They'll compromise those relationships for money and power and position and wealth. And that becomes kind of their true north. That's what they're after. That's what they're about. Here's what connects them. What connects them is this, is that work always reveals to you what you truly worship. Work and worship are intrinsically intertwined. The way that you view and approach work is actually revealing something very deep about the deepest longings of your soul. And you need to listen to what it's telling you. It's a GPS that is revealing to you the direction that you're actually heading in what you are pursuing your satisfaction and your joy and your delight in. And what confronts us is that the sluggard and the cheat, I think they're actually a part of all of our DNA. I think at times all of us have the capacity to live one of these out. Some of us probably at times have lived both of them out, right? As we think about work and labor and vocation, sometimes we're just in it and we're working super hard, but we're working for the wrong means and the wrong ends. And some of us at times, maybe we're trying to avoid desperately any form of that. So it begs the question, why is work so hard? How many of you love Monday mornings? That you have a job and you're just like, I can't wait to go to that job. I'm so excited about, like, some of us might love our jobs, but that's very different than like, I'm loving going there today, right? It's always hard. It's always difficult. It's always challenging. I spent the better part of my life as an adult working with teenagers. It was a super fun job, right? But there were times where I was like, it's hard too. And like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? There was a time and a moment in my life, I'm holed up in this garage and I'm painting over like 100 different wiffle balls is what I'm trying to say. I'm painting them all different sorts of colors. I'm in my mid to like late 30s at this point, right? And I'm just like in this garage, I'm painting them all different colors. And I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Like, I'm stuck in a garage painting wiffle balls, all sorts of various colors, over 100 of them, right? And I was like, this is weird. And then at the same moment, I thought about my buddy who like worked in a cubicle, and I was like, look at what I'm doing with my life. Like, I'm not in a cubicle, I'm in this garage, and I get to paint wiffle balls all day. Like, it's always hard, and it always feels like it wars against us. So to kind of answer why work is hard, I think you got to kind of go back to the beginning. Is there a point in which we get an answer outside of what the author of Proverbs tells us about work and why it's hard? I think the book of Genesis, I think we really get a clear concept of God's intentions for humans and for work. We see how it fits into their lives, not as our God that defines us, but as a means of worshiping and honoring and following God on his mission. And so here's what you're going to find. If we were to flip back and kind of go through Genesis 1, 2, and you have to hit 3, and you ask questions about work and vocation, here's what you're going to find. You're going to find in the beginning, before there was any sin, God stamps work with divine dignity. Here's why. God himself actually works. In God's work of creation, he's stamping work with divine dignity. It says, out of nothing, God creates everything that exists. And he does that merely by speaking it into existence. And that's work for him, okay? The very first act of work is God opening his mouth and speaking. So he stamps divine dignity on work because God, who is perfect, actually works. Are you tracking with that? Does that make sense? So God gives us this example of work. Like, he's in it. He's working. He creates everything out of nothing. And he stamps dignity on every form of labor or vocation or work that contributes to human flourishing. The whole spectrum of work, right? From the neurosurgeon to the sandwich artist at Subway, God's saying, I'm stamping all of that with divine dignity. And then God also does this in the story of Genesis, and you can kind of see as it unfolds. He establishes this rhythm when it comes to work. In Genesis 1, God creates, and he works during the day. And then at the end of that day, he does something really interesting. He stops. Right? He stops. He ceases from his labor, and in his daily rhythm, what does he do? He reflects on what he did during that day. He steps back, stops working, right? And he looks at what he accomplished in work, and he says, this is good. What I created, what I did, what I worked out today is good. I got a lot of stuff done. This was a good day. And then there's this weekly rhythm that he establishes. He gets to the end of the work week and he institutes this thing called the Sabbath, in which he ceases from his labor and he rests. Now, it's important to understand this. God doesn't rest on the Sabbath because he's like, that was so hard. I'm so exhausted. He's not tired. He doesn't get tired. It's not like he got to the end of a hard work week and he's like, man, I need a break and I need a beer. You know, that's not God, right? He doesn't get tired. He gets to the end of his week and he rests because he's instituting something important about work. Daily and weekly rhythms are a part of God's plan to restrain chaos from the world. So think about it this way. Work too much, right? Overwork, or work too little, underwork, and chaos ensues in our souls, in our homes, in our families, in our churches, and in our cities. If we overwork or underwork, chaos will ensue. But then here's what he does next. And he does this crazy generous thing. Okay, you go through Genesis 1 and 2. He's creating everything, right? He gets to the point where he creates the first humans, right? And then some of us, I think some of us, if we're honest, we actually view work as a curse, right? And maybe you're like, I don't even know where I fit in between the sluggard and the cheat. I just don't like work. It's just hard. And it feels like it's the curse, right? But the interesting thing is that work comes in pre-fall. Like before sin, before rebellion, before folly, God is generous with work in that he makes man and woman in his own image and he shares work with them. He gives them work to do. He gives us jobs, okay? If you look at Genesis 1 verses 26 through 28, he gives them this really like robust job, right? They are to multiply and to fill the earth. And that's not merely like just procreation that we're talking about, but he says, fill the entire world, spread out and fill the world with beauty and order that points to who I am as the creator. So you're to go out and be my image bearers throughout the whole world and point people back to me. He gives them this job and it's hard and it's difficult. And he puts them in this garden. And Genesis 2:15, he says, take, look at this garden, like work it and keep it and tend it. And it's going to give you everything that you need, but you have to work it. You have to work the soil. So here's what's crazy. Many of us think that work is something that came into the universe again, like after sin entered, after everything was broken. But here's the reality. Before sin and death, God gives work to human beings because work is an important part of what it means to be human. Okay? And then this is important. Adam and Eve, they didn't find their identity or sense of purpose in their jobs. Right? They didn't pursue meaning through their job that God had given them. Rather, they found their identity in their relationship with Creator God. Their value, their comfort, their security, and their worth was not in their work, but their fruitfulness in work was to flow out of their relationship with God. In his book, Every Good Endeavor, which I can't recommend enough, I read like 20 quotes from it this morning. It's so good. Tim Keller writes this: work is as much a basic human need as food, beauty, rest, friendship, prayer, and sexuality. It's not simply medicine, but food for our soul. Without meaningful work, we sense significant inner loss and emptiness. It's essential. Work is not what makes you a human, but work is one of the blessings of being a human. How many of you view work that way? Right? It's hard. I mean, we don't often, but this sets, I think, hopefully our compasses back in. Like, we worship God. We don't worship work. Work is not meant to be something in our life that wars against us. It's actually being redeemed through the finished work of Jesus. So in the beginning, right, God works. Work is shared. Work is stamped with divine dignity. Work is important. He establishes these rhythms to work. And in Genesis chapter 3, everything goes totally wrong. Everything breaks. Humanity breaks. creation breaks, work breaks. God has this conversation with Adam and Eve. They've now sinned. They've turned to folly. They've left wisdom. They've abandoned God and his ways, and they've chosen themselves to be their own gods. And God has this conversation after that initial sinful act of rebellion, right? And it's a really pointed conversation. It's a painful conversation, right? They turned their backs on God and his goodness. They sinned against him. Death has now entered into creation, and everything was twisted because of their rebellion. And that includes work and vocation and labor. So he has this conversation with him, and he says, hey, you're going to work now by the sweat of your brow. You're going to work really hard. You're going to try, and you're going to get food out. You're going to try to get food out of the ground. And instead of the ground just opening up and giving you the productivity and the produce that you need, the ground's actually going to fight you. It's going to war against you. It's going to be back-breaking, and it's going to sometimes yield thorn and thistles. And ultimately, here's what God's saying. For every single human being, right, because of the sin of our first parents, it's part of who we are. It's what we're born with. Work is going to feel often futile, and it's always going to be hard, right? That wasn't God's intention and design for work. But now it's going to often feel futile, which we get. You get to the end of a hard day, you look at what you did, and you just go, what was any of this for? Did this accomplish anything? And it's always difficult and hard. Like, we can just admit that about work. It often feels futile. And that's because we live in this sinful world, right? We're a sinful people, and sin has affected us, and it's affected our coworkers, and it's affected where we work, it's affected our cities, it's affected everything. And it often feels futile, and it's always hard. So in Proverbs, we see the sluggard who worships the god of comfort and ease, and then there's the cheat who's willing to do anything necessary to worship his gods of power and wealth and position. What does that come out of? Where does that come from? Here's what I want you to see. What we do as human beings, because of our brokenness, because of our sin, because of the curse on our labor, what we do is this. We either overwork or we underwork, or some maybe weird combination of the two. When we overwork, right, when we're the cheat who's willing to do whatever necessary to obtain what we find most valuable, here's what we're really saying. When we overwork as hard as we can, what we're really saying is, I don't need a savior. I will be my own savior. I'm going to work it out on my own. I've got this. With enough hard work, I can fix all the things that are broken. Sure, God, you might say that the ground's really hard and it's going to produce some thorns and some thistles, but through my hard work and through my own efforts, I'll somehow be able to undo the curse with no need for Christ on the cross. I'll be able to fulfill my deepest longings, however misguided they are, through my own efforts. Now, I don't think we have a room full of like Bernie Madoffs in here. I'm not accusing you of being that level, right? But those of us who are overworkers and you know who you are and you justify it in all sorts of ways, I think we try to deal with our own sinful and broken world by having these unjust scales. We're tipping the scales in our own favor. And here's how that fleshes out. Every time that you overwork, you've had these unjust scales, right? With your kids and with your spouses, because you're neglecting them, right? And you're stepping on them just to get what you think that you need. So when we work in ways that neglect our families and the responsibilities that we have at home, right? Or if we corrupt relationships in our workplace, we're not living out God's rhythm of working hard. Like, it's not to say that you don't work hard, but then you step back and you reflect on your day. And then you engage in those relationships. That's that daily rhythm that God establishes. You don't stay at work for 20 hours and go like, I'm trying to provide for the family. Like, you're cheating. You're tipping those scales because you're fulfilling something in your own heart that you need. And you're tipping the scales against those that desperately need you to be home and engage in those relationships. So when you overwork, you're like that cheat in Proverbs. You're willing to cheat your spouse out of their covenant partner. You're willing to cheat your kids out of their parent. When you overwork, the compass of your soul is pointing to what you really think will satisfy you and save you. And it's not the God that created you. It's something that he made. Now, opposite, when we underwork, when we're the sluggard, we're actually doing the same thing, just different results, right? The underworker doesn't say, like, I'm going to undo the curse by working really hard, right? They don't. They try to avoid work. The underworker says this: I'm going to avoid the pain of the curse. If it's going to be hard, if it's going to produce thorn and thistles, then I'm just not going to work at all. The underworker looks at those thorns and those thistles and says, I'll just come up with any way possible to avoid that. So I'll stay in bed, right? I'll show up, but I'm not going to put any effort out. There might be lions. Maybe I just won't go today. I don't want that pain or the difficulty of what it would actually mean to do that work. This ground's not going to produce anything, only thorns and thistles. And so I'd rather just do what's easy. I'll worship the gods of leisure and recreation and rest and comfort instead of the God of the universe who has given me a mission of work and vocation. So both really, right? Both really have a worship problem when it comes down to it. What they value, what's sitting on the throne of their hearts, is not the God of the universe who created all of this. It's probably something that he created. Right? They're partners in creating gods that aren't God. And I think at times, every single one of us in the room have been somewhere on that spectrum. Right? We've been there and we understand it. So what do we do with this? What do we do with the brokenness and how sin has affected work and vocation? Let's go back to Proverbs real quick. Proverbs 16:3. Commit your work to the Lord. That word work there, it's kind of a catch-all, right? It includes really all the things in your life that you're doing. Certainly your vocation, commit that to the Lord. The work of your hands, the work of your relationships, like everything in your life is meant to be seen as something that you should commit to the Lord. It's the work that you're doing. It says, commit that work to the Lord. And then look what it says. It says, and your plans will be established. Now, this doesn't mean commit your work with like a trite prayer. Like you're driving into work and like, here's just a prayer that I throw up. And if I throw this prayer up, I'm giving this to you today, God. Certainly that's okay. But it doesn't mean if you just do that, there you get everything that you want. Your plans are going to be fine and everything's going to work out good for you. That's not the point here. Here's what it's actually saying. Committing your work to the Lord means that you actually see Jesus Christ, right, as the embodiment of all that Proverbs is pointing to. Proverbs is pointing us to a life of wisdom to obtain this life that aligns itself with ultimate reality, which is in fact God and Jesus and who he is. And so it's saying, pursue Christ. That's what committing your work to the Lord means. It means pursuing Jesus and pursuing the wisdom that he embodies. All of Proverbs is pointing us this deep longing that we have in our heart and our life for true wisdom, and that's fulfilled in the life and the person of the one that is true wisdom incarnate, who is Jesus. So I think we're meant to see this from Proverbs. While it certainly addresses all sorts of topics, you can go through the list of topics that Proverbs addresses: money, relationship, anger, parenting, food and drink, and justice and work, and etc. Just everything that it talks about. More than we are to see those things as a list of like here's why we do these things, or here's what we are supposed to do, or here's how we're supposed to do them. The book of Proverbs first and foremost points us to a who. It draws us to a who. And it draws us to Jesus. So here's the deal. Jesus did something really crazy. A lot of you have heard this before, but just pretend like it's the first time that you're hearing it. Jesus, who is the second person of the Trinity, of the Godhead, right? He was born of a virgin. He was born both God and human, 100% both fully divine and human. And he did this really crazy thing. He's the only human being in the whole history of the universe that perfectly and completely kept all of the law of God. He kept the law externally with what he did and with what he said. But even more important than kind of his external obedience, it flowed out of a heart internally that loved his Father. He actually delighted in keeping the law. He showed up. He worked a job. Jesus came and taught us what it means to be human, the way that God intended it, and he actually worked a job. And then Jesus, after all that life of perfect obedience to the Father's will, he was betrayed, he was arrested, he was brutally tortured, nailed to a Roman cross. Jesus suffered physically in horrible ways, but what he suffered spiritually on that cross was far worse. What happened to Jesus on the cross was this. He that knew no sin, perfectly obeyed the law, the one perfect human, became sin on our behalf. Jesus willingly, right? It's not cosmic child abuse here. It's God's work to redeem us. Jesus willingly received all of our sin, all of our brokenness, all of our ugliness, all of our treason on himself, all of our sluggardly avoidance of work and pain, and all of our efforts to overwork that try to build a kingdom for ourselves that will satisfy us, all of our misdirected worship. Jesus took all of that, put it upon himself on a cross, and the Father poured out the just condemnation for that sin on Jesus, and Jesus received it willingly. He experienced the wrath of the Father. He died fully. He was buried. 3 days later, he walked out of a tomb, rose from the dead, which is the Father's declaration of vindication. It's the Father saying, this man, Jesus, is who he said he was. He said he was the truth and the life and the way. Listen to him. So what does that have to do with our misdirected views of work and vocation and labor? Here's what having a relationship with Jesus means. It's far more than, well, now I'm a Christian, so overworking is bad, right? It's far more than that. Like we don't need a list of 10 things to make sure that you're not overworking today. Right? They exist. Like, don't check your email at home. Don't stay late at work. Like, make sure you have a date night. Those things are all good. Those things are all fine. But there's an invitation of Jesus by grace through faith in Christ. And what that means is this: the one voice that matters in the universe the most already accepts me completely through Jesus. The one voice who has the power to create everything out of nothing looked at me because I belong to Jesus and doesn't say, try harder and maybe I'll love you more. He says, it's finished. You're mine. For the overworker who believes that their stuff will satisfy them, Jesus is saying, I'm the treasure. I'm the treasure that you've already received. I'm what you need. And for the sluggard, the invitation of Jesus is this. Yeah, you're going to fail. Yeah, you're going to show up and it's going to feel futile and it's always going to be hard. And you're going to experience pain and loss. But you're never going to stop being mine. And you can find rest, ultimate Sabbath in me. So you don't need to stay in bed to avoid. Engage. Show up. So you can cease either your overwork or your underwork. No longer trusting in it to find fulfillment in it, but trusting in the finished work of Jesus. So we're going to take some time here this morning to respond. My hope, my prayer as we were kind of walking through this was that maybe Tuesday, well, the reality is Tuesday when you show up, it's going to be hard. It's not the point. But maybe in thinking about who Christ is and what he's done, maybe Tuesday will have more fulfillment and meaning as you work as you put forth that effort because you trust in what Jesus has done for you already. So let's respond, and we're going to do this in a few ways. We're going to sing. The band's going to come back up here, and we'll sing some songs of worship to Jesus. And I hope in our prayer in that moment is that Jesus is truly what you're fixing your heart on. He is truly what you're worshiping. We'll take some moments to pray. Also here at Hub City, one of the ways that we worship is through giving. If you're a guest with us this morning, you don't need to participate in that. We're not here and you're not here because we think, hey, we need money from you. If you call Hub City your home, we'd love for you to engage in worship through giving. You can do that. There's some boxes around the room here. You can give online. And then finally, we get to go to the tables and we get to receive Jesus's free gift of grace through the breaking of his body and the pouring out of his blood. We receive Jesus's body and blood, and we thank him and we worship him and we remember what he's accomplished for us in his finished work. So let me pray and we'll respond. Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for your word. We thank you that we get to join in and this Monday, while probably most of us will actually be out playing. I hope and pray that we, rather than worshiping what we do with our vocation or our work, we would worship the one who gave us a mission to fill this earth with your image bearers, to fill this earth with your disciples, and point people towards the order and the beauty and the goodness that you bring through your kingdom. I pray that as we play, as we recreate, as we work, we would be worshiping you. In your name we pray. Amen.